This audio recording is under copyright protection, all rights reserved. Any duplication, transmission, or broadcast without permission is strictly prohibited by U.S. and international laws.
It's good to be here. Thank you all for coming. This first talk, Nurturing Competent Communicators, is, I believe, perhaps the most important stuff that I know. If you were to, say, walk up to me on the street with a little baby in your arms and say, oh, hey, Mr. Pudua, I heard that you know something about helping people become good users of the English language, and I would like this baby to be a good speaker and writer of English 20 years from now, what should I do? This is the talk you would get. Now, I started on this line of thinking many, many years ago. I had an opportunity to do some work with some public school districts, and I had learned a lot from working in public schools. One of the things that I learned was that a lot of teachers believe something that is not true. And I began to wonder, number one, why do they believe it? Number two, why is it not true? And the thing that many people believe, which is not true, is that good readers will naturally or automatically become good writers, that good reading is the cause of good writing. And if kids would just read more, just read, 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 if everybody would just read more, that would solve all of our problems in teaching writing. And I know this is not true, and I have seen kids, maybe you've seen children who read very well, 3, 4, 5 grade levels above their peers, read anything you throw at them with great comprehension, but they still don't write as well as you would expect for such a literate person. So I started to wonder about this idea. And another thing that happened right around that same time was I was giving a talk on a different subject. I was talking about spelling. And I said something, it came out of my mouth, I heard what I said, and I thought, whoa, that's brilliant. Actually, not all that brilliant, kind of obvious, but what I said had tremendous impact on my thinking. And that was that you can't get something out of a brain that isn't in there to begin with, right? So if you're talking about spelling, you don't get correctly spelled words out of a brain that doesn't have a good database of correctly spelled words. You don't get Chinese out of a brain that doesn't have Chinese. You don't get physics out of a brain that doesn't have physics. And I was thinking, okay, my job in teaching writing to children is to help them get out of their brain reliably correct and appropriately sophisticated language, English language. And I was thinking about this, and I thought maybe the problem is not entirely on the getting it out so much as it's dependent on the putting it in. So I began a path of inquiry to think, where do most children get most of their language input on a daily basis? Well, what would you guess? Statistically, what would you guess is the number one influence on language coming into the brains, the minds, the ears of school-age children in our country today? What would you guess, statistically? Maybe not your kids, because, you know, we do things a little differently, but the average kid in the average situation, number one influence? Television. And of course, this was 20 years ago when television was much more dominant. Now we would expand it to other forms of electronic media. So in addition to television, we have all of the streaming, we have all of the YouTubes, we have, you know, we could expand it to music, we could even expand it to visual media, right? Everything from, say, comic books to billboards, right? So you would just step back and say, would that, television and other forms of popular media, would that provide for children a source of reliably correct and appropriately sophisticated English language? No, actually, if anything, it's kind of the opposite, isn't it? It would be reliably unsophisticated and frequently incorrect. And if you're not sure, just try a little experiment. Find a television somewhere. I've done this on a few occasions, usually in a hotel room. Just turn it on randomly. Don't look at it, but just listen to the vocabulary and the complexity of the syntax. And what you will realize very quickly is that it is very dumbed down. Even shows for adults tend to be dumbed down. Shows for kids are even more frightening in that how profoundly dumbed down they can be. And I thought, wow, that's frightening, because at least at one point, and I don't know what the statistics are at this moment, but I remember reading many years ago, the average school age child watches 25 hours a week of television or similar media. That is a huge influence, which is not providing what I need as a teacher of writing, which is a source of reliably correct and appropriately sophisticated English language. So I thought, well, okay, that wipes out the number one source, but let's continue. What would you suspect for the average school-age child in this country is the number two source of language coming into their ears, coming into their minds on a daily basis? What would you guess? Yeah, friends, peers. And that would be especially true if they go to schools where they spend most of their time in age-segregated environments. Well, you don't have to go too far to ask yourself the question, do peers provide for children a source of reliably correct and sophisticated English? Now, if anything, it's kind of the opposite, isn't it? And you know, if you're not sure, just try a little experiment. Get a room of half a dozen nine-year-old girls and spy on them and listen to the linguistic interactions that occur, and you will realize that they very quickly sink down to the lowest common level, right? Of course, if you get a little room of, say, half a dozen nine-year-old boys, they're not even talking. It's just building warfare and sound effects. But I have noted that this problem of this heavy influence on peers, they do tend to almost naturally, instinctively sink down to the lowest common level. Because, you know, if you're 9 years old and I'm 9 years old, there's two things that are distinctly uncool. One thing would be for me to say, oh, that David, he's so well-spoken and polite and intelligent, I want to be more like him. Not going to happen. The other thing that is not likely to happen is for him to say, oh, that Andrew, he's pretty rough. He needs a good example. I need to be well-spoken and intelligent when I'm around. No, if we're going to have a relationship, he's going to have to sink down to my level. And then when you expand that out, it gets even lower. So when you think about it, probably the worst possible language development environment you could create intentionally, if you wanted to do so, would be get 26 nine-year-olds in one room for 7 or 8 hours a day, because they would sink down to this level. And then, of course, you would encourage those children to spend almost all of their extra time with children their same age in after school or extracurricular activities or playing with friends. And, you know, my kids always love playing with kids their own age. I don't fault them for that. But I am acutely aware of the fact that it is not going to give them a source of, what do I want? Reliably correct and appropriately sophisticated English language input. So I thought, well, okay. Top two sources for most kids, not what I need, but let's continue. What would you guess would be the number three, statistically, the number three influence on children's language? Parents. Yes, we would say parents, and by extension, other busy adults, with the operative word being busy. Because I don't know about you, but I am very busy. I have always been very busy. I cannot even remember not being busy, but I'm not special. Pretty much everyone I know is profoundly busy. And it's just the way life is. And, you know, I fear if you had attached maybe a little recording device to me and recorded all of my interactions with my children over all the years that they were at home, most of what you would have heard would not qualify as being reliably correct or sophisticated English. A lot of it would have been something like, "What do you mean you can't find your shoes? Now you get your shoes and you get them on and you get in the car. We're going to be late. Now move." Or, "You're going to have that math homework finished or you're not going to eat ever. So get to work." And even when I'm in a good mood, "Oh, you're doing a great job. Keep on with that. I need to go over here and do something very important. I'll check back on you in a while," right? And I used to actually have my idyllic vision of dinner with the family. It goes kind of like this. I'm in my office, emptying my email inbox, feeling successful. My son walks in and says, "Father, dinner is on the table as I speak. Your presence is requested." And I believe him. So I immediately stop what I'm doing and I go into the house there and I sit down at my spot at the head of the table. Children are lined up along the sides, hands and faces washed, waiting patiently to say grace. My wife in the kitchen. Delicious smells are wafting my way. She's smiling. And I sit down and think, yes, tonight is the night. Conditions are perfect. The stars are lined up. Tonight, we are going to have a conversation. We'll talk about maybe a little bit of history or some current events or maybe some philosophy or theology or a book that somebody's reading. I don't really care. As long as we have a good conversation, I will feel successful. And then reality hits. First thing that happens is someone, spills milk. Right? So the milk spills and it drips. Notice the passive voice there. It drips off the table onto someone's jeans, at which point you have to cry because, you know, you're not supposed to cry over spilt milk, but now there's milk on your jeans. That jeans person has to go change because you can't eat dinner in milk-soaked jeans. Meanwhile, I got to bully someone into cleaning it up because I didn't spill it. Yeah, I know, nobody spilled it, but it spilled. And so someone's going to clean it up. And then you got to have a little argument about whether you use a sponge or paper towels. Because if you use a sponge, you won't get it dry. You have to use paper towels anyway. But if you use paper towels, you're going to waste too many paper towels. And so you're going to have to use a sponge and then paper towel. And by the time you get the milk cleaned up and the jeans person back, someone over here is arguing, "You got all the broccoli heads and I got all the broccoli stems. And I don't like broccoli stems as much as I like broccoli heads. So I demand that you trade me some of your broccoli stems for some of these broccoli heads." And I am sitting there thinking, "Would you just shut up and eat it? It's just broccoli." And by the time that is resolved, well, the teenager, she's done. She doesn't eat much, has to keep her trim figure. She stands up and says, "I need to be excused right now because my friend is having a real big problem. And if I don't go talk to her on the phone, she might kill herself. So goodbye." And I think, do I want to fight this particular battle with this particular teenager at this particular moment and decide, no, I don't. Right? And then sweet 11-year-old says, "Could I please be excused because I'm dishes tonight and there's really a lot of dishes because mom used so many pots and pans to make dinner and I still have to do my Latin homework before I go to Latin class tomorrow morning and I really hate to go to Latin class without my Latin homework done. So can I please be excused to do all the dishes right now because it's my job?" And how do you say no to that? And then the phone rings and your wife is gone for the next 2 hours. And pretty soon there I am all alone at the table, eating all the leftovers, which I should not have been doing, thinking, where is my family? Can you relate? And I finally figured it out. I finally figured out the number one enemy of my family being in one room for any significant length of time, having any meaningful conversation and interaction, is electricity. If there was no electricity, there would be nowhere to go and nothing to do. But now, you know, when I was growing up, there was one phone. It was on the wall. It had a cord attached. Now everybody's got their own phone. Right? They could be anywhere on the property. And someone, you know, has to do some very important internet research on which homeopathic remedy will solve their headache of the moment. And then someone else has to answer an extremely important email. And then someone else wants to watch an educational video. I don't know, some of you are old enough to remember Y2K, 1999. I was hopeful. I actually was looking forward to the idea of the whole grid just shutting down for a while, and there'd be nowhere to go and nothing to do, and we would cook our stored up food on a campfire in the backyard and talk for a while. But it didn't happen. I'm still holding out for sunspots or something, but I do think that it is very, very difficult in today's modern world to carve out these opportunities to have these types of in-depth, meaningful, sophisticated, linguistic interchanges with our children. And I try harder than most people, and I still come up short. So I thought, wow, this is rough now. I'm trying to help all these teachers with these kids in schools, and I'm realizing that most of these kids, most of the time, are not getting in this stream of what's so essentially needed in terms of vocabulary and sophisticated syntax and grammar. So I thought, well, okay, let's keep going, because there is one more source of language that would be coming into children's minds on a daily basis, and that would be books. Yes, which gets me right back to where I started, right? Books. Now, if you think about it, books, if you read even half-decent ones, they should provide for children a source of reliably correct and appropriately sophisticated English. So it makes sense that teachers would believe that if children would read more, they would get more, and if they got more, they would write better. It makes sense. But then I noticed something about children and reading. And there are different aptitudes in this area, but we can almost divide kids into two general groups. The ones who read and like reading and do it in their spare time, and the ones who don't. Well, now, the kids who like reading and read a lot, how do they read? They read kind of like you and I would, fast. In fact, I noticed this about kids who love to read. They read books like they watch movies. The books are page turners, and they read very, very quickly because they want to know what's going to happen next. And then most books are in a series. You end the book, and then you've got to quickly get the next book to find out what's going to happen, right? And so they're very engaged, but I realized they are reading too fast to hear all the words on the page. In fact, the speed reading people, if you take a little course or you learn about speed reading, they actually tell you, if you hear all the words in your mind, if you internally audiate the words, you're reading too slowly to be speed reading. I now am reading a book called How to Read Slowly. I've been on this book for years. But I thought, this kind of explains why the kids who read a lot and love to read don't necessarily gain the facility with the language. They will do what you or I will do. See a word you don't quite know? Skip it. You don't need to know that word to get the story. See a phrase or an idiom or an allusion that you're not familiar with or doesn't make sense? Skip it. See like a whole sentence or maybe a paragraph that's not important to the story. Skip it. I mean, let's face it, you can skip huge chunks of Tolkien and still get the story. I remember one time I was reading a book. I don't remember exactly what it was. And I was reading it to a kid. And she goes, Dad, would you just skip that part? You want me to skip this part? She goes, yeah, it's not important. Well, that gives me a little insight into how you read. So I realized that kids who read a lot, very often, they're getting the image, they're getting the story, they're engaged in it, but they're not necessarily getting the complete language patterns. Then, of course, what about the other kids who don't read a lot? They don't read in their spare time. They'll read if you ask them or force them to, but they would rather be doing other stuff, right? Drawing pictures or playing music or building forts or playing Legos. That they would rather do that. So what's their problem? They're just not reading enough. So I thought, wow, this is so fascinating. This explains why there's so many kids out there who are not getting that reliably correct and appropriately sophisticated building of language in their minds to be good writers. So, what is the solution? And I realized that the solution, it kind of used to exist naturally in the world, and that was reading aloud to children. Right? We had the bedtime story culture. I grew up every night, one of my parents, usually my father, would read a bedtime story. It was just a part of the way things were for a long time, but it's definitely dying out. And it's much more likely now that everyone is so busy and distracted. You know, I think about maybe 100 years ago, 150 years ago. Have you ever read these letters from Civil War soldiers? These are just like random people who had maybe an eighth grade education at the time, and yet they wrote this beautiful prose. Would put any of us to shame. How was this possible? Well, I know. No electricity, right? Because you think 150 years ago, there's no electricity. There's really nowhere to go and nothing to do except what? Stay in your home. Light and heat were more expensive. And so everybody's in the same room. And your kind of only form of entertainment was reading to each other and talking to each other. So it was kind of normal for people to read to the whole family. And there was this literacy that built kind of organically just in the process of living in that world at that time. And we had this very, very high literacy in this country. And then with electricity, you see almost a decline of literacy over the century. So I thought, wow, this is so interesting. We really need, I think, to reestablish the bedtime story idea. We need to reestablish this habit of parents reading aloud to children. Now, you know, it's nice if teachers could do this. And I think they used to be able to do it more easily. You meet people and say, oh, that was the best part of school. We would come in from recess, and the teacher would read us a chapter book, and we would just put our head on our desk and listen for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. But that's harder today because education is connected with test scores and all sorts of, you know, things that have to be done every day. I was giving a version of this talk at a reading conference. So it was all teachers. And after the talk, this woman came up to me and said, you know, you are so right. I came into teaching later after I'd raised my children. I did my student teaching right down the road here. And I started, you know, to read a book to the children. And after 4 days, my supervising teacher said, well, what are you doing? And she said, well, I'm reading to the children. And he said, well, you can't do that. You don't have time. This is high stakes. This is fourth grade. This is, you know, standardized tests. So it's kind of died out, both in the home, been eclipsed by technology, and it doesn't have its place anymore in the daily life of children. To hear that reliably correct, appropriately sophisticated, beautiful language from books. So I became convicted on this point, and I realized that I am guilty, as I think a lot of dads are, of just being so busy, right? I mean, you probably know, your kid says, well, dad, are you gonna read me a story? And you think, of course, That's my job. I'm the dad. So you go over to the Book of Virtues or something, and you open it up, and you start looking for a story which is just the right length. That's the trick. Because if you get only like a page and a half story and you're finished in 6 minutes, your son will say, "What? That is not long enough to qualify as a real bedtime story. Foul! You have to read another one." And you'll know it's true, and you'll have to read another one. But if you accidentally stumble into some 17-page behemoth that's going to take you 45 minutes, let's face it, we do not put children to bed so that they get more sleep. No, we put children to bed so that they get out of our way, so we can do all the things that we want to get done before we collapse into bed. But who are we cheating? I mean, come on, guys. How many of us are going to go to our deathbed thinking, well, if I just could have stolen another half an hour a day from my family, I could die with the inbox empty? No, it's the opposite. And I'm old enough to tell you, right? You're gonna say, wow, if I had just trashed the whole inbox and stolen that time and given it to my children when they were still with me, the world would be a better place. So I was convicted. So one night at the dinner table, I announced to the family, new law. I will tell you, this is the best thing about being a dad, is it's as close to being like God as you will ever get. You can just decree things into existence, and there's no board or committee or legislature to mess with you. Almost no one to veto. It's power, right? So I said, family, new law, tonight. No one in this family is going to go see that movie, Lord of the Rings. Remember when the first Lord of the Rings movie was coming out? That's how long ago this was. It was so exciting. Like, yes, they're going to make a movie. It's going to be fantastic. So I said, no one in this family is going to go see that movie. Mom included, myself included, everyone, no one is going to go see that movie until I, the dad, have read this entire book out loud to you. We start tonight, and there is no opting out. So we did. And I quickly learned a few things about my children, which I had not noticed before. The first thing I noticed is that teenagers have a harder time sitting still and doing this than little kids, right? Because it was the teenager who was sitting there. Do I really have to sit here and listen to you read this? Because you know what? I could read this on my own. In fact, I already have read this on my own. And I don't know why I have to sit here and listen to you read it just so I can go see a movie. It's just not right or fair. And I said, no, you will sit here and you will listen and you will enjoy it. But then sometimes the Lord, in his goodness, will answer our prayers before we are smart enough to pray them. And what happened with this was one of the older girls came home and somehow got everybody into, what's that thing you do with one hook? Crochet, yes. So got these girls into crocheting. Now, I'm pretty sure I couldn't crochet a strip this long to save my life, but somehow they started doing this thing with this hook and making stuff. And it was like magic. As soon as that teenager's hands were busy, she was fine. She was happy. She sat there. She did enjoy it. But she just had to be doing something. She's that type of person. I can completely relate. I am naturally hyperactive myself. And so I get that feeling like I'm not doing something. And so it was beautiful. As soon as her hands were busy, she was happy. Problem solved. Another thing I noticed is that you cannot judge attentiveness by behavior. Number six kid, my son, he was not even 6 years old at the time. So he's just a little kid. He's on the floor in his Lego universe, right? And I'm reading this book, Fellowship of the Ring, And the main problem was when he does Legos, he would talk to himself and make noise and sound effects all the time. So I'm trying to read and he's over there going, get here, no, shoot him now, right? I'm like, shh, you, volume off, I'm reading. Be quiet. I didn't really expect him to be following it too much because, you know, Lord of the Rings. Well, after a few weeks, I got this habit of asking the family, what was the last thing that we read yesterday or the last time we read? And he would always be the one who would pop up and go, well, Legolas and Gimli were arguing about blah, 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 blah. And he would like narrate the whole thing back. I remember thinking, you even heard that? Let alone remembered it? So you can't judge his attentiveness by his behavior. I also learned that you can't judge attentiveness by behavior in a different way. Charming 11-year-old, snuggled up against her mom. Every time I would look at her, she would be looking right at me, smiling. And I remember thinking, what a beautiful, intelligent, attentive child I have. We'd been at it weeks. Finally, she gets up her gumption. She goes, Dad, can I ask a question? Sure, sweetie. Is Mary a girl? No, Meriadoc is a hobbit, a male hobbit, as are all the hobbits in this story so far. Is there anything else that's gone completely past you? And then if you have enough kids, which I highly recommend, I mean, have as many children as you can. But if you have enough, you'll get one of every sort. And so you'll get good classroom management as a result. So this was 9-year-old who wanted to constantly interrupt. She would interrupt every sentence. Well, how come you did that? And what's going to happen about that? Stop. Okay. When you have a question, raise one finger. I will notice that you're raising one finger. I'll know you have a question. When I come to a convenient place, I will stop reading and you can ask the question. Now you won't remember the question you had when you raised your finger, but you will have some other question in your mind, which I will be happy to answer. But if I answer every question you're going to have, we will still be reading this book by the time Return of the King comes out on DVD extended version 5 years from now. Anyway, we did it. We got through the whole book by the time the movie came out at Christmas. And then those of us who were old enough went to see it, and those who were not stayed home and cried about that. But I will say this changed the culture in the home because it became a priority. And that's really what you have to do. You have to make it the most important thing for a period of time. Because if you don't, everything will impinge, right? Everything will eclipse that. And so you kind of have to let stuff go. You know, if you're a dad who likes watching sports, you may have to give up some sports watching. If you've got urgent things you want to do, you may have to say, is this really more important, even though it's urgent, than helping my children right now grow in their language and their imagination and their attentiveness and all of those magnificent things that come of it? So, anyone feeling a little convicted on this point? Good. Yeah, so I'm going to give you some tips. These are some pointers. Number one thing I recommend is read whole books. Now, I love fairy tales. I love short stories. But whole books will drive you to do more reading, right? I remember I was reading books and I would get to the end of the chapter, right? And I would think or maybe say, I wonder if we have time for another chapter. And I would look at my children. I would look at the clock. I would look at my wife. I would look at the clock. I would look at my children and say, yes, I think we do. And I would read more. And the kids are like, yay, Dad! Right? Besides, you know, we homeschooled. And I will tell you, we did not homeschool so that our children could get up early. This was not a goal. right? And so, you know, you use the time when you have it. So read whole books. That's the first thing. It'll drive you to do more reading. Number two, read books that you want to read, right? If you're enjoying the reading, then everyone will be enjoying it. If you are not enjoying it, then you will not, they will not enjoy it. They will figure out pretty quickly, this is horrible. I remember what happened. Finished Fellowship of the Ring, went to see the movie, New Year, of course, what am I gonna do? Start in on the Two Towers. I personally died in Mordor. I was slogging through this thing, hating, dreading having to do it. And finally, I just got to a point where I said, I'm not doing this. If you want to read this book, go ahead. We'll talk about the movie later, but I am not going to read this. So I quit. I quit because it was miserable and nobody was having fun. And then I launched into a much better book. So if you read things that you want to read, then that will help you a lot. The third thing is it has to be non-optional, right? So, you know, however old your kids are, you start reading at a level above the oldest one's decoding skills, right? And then just let it trickle down. And don't worry if everybody understands everything. You know, people worry, oh, my three-year-old doesn't understand it. Your three-year-old doesn't understand everything anyway, all the time, right? But you don't censor their world. You just flow language into it. So it has to be non-optional because if you make exceptions, well, pretty soon the teenager is gone because they already read it or they have something more important to do, and pretty soon mom is gone, pretty soon the next kid is gone, and then it's just you and the four-year-old reading Ping and the beautiful Yangtze River one more time. There's something about Ping. It's a true classic. Anyway, so if everyone's in the room, then you can keep it going much more easily and everyone gets the benefits, but they can do stuff, crochet, play with Legos. My wife would sit in there with her laptop and, you know, do whatever she does on a laptop, answer emails or research homeopathic remedies, I don't know. So, you know, but if everyone's in the room, then it goes much better. And so those are the three kind of points I would recommend for you. And you will discover that it's transformative. And I would say that my wife would probably look back on the years of our having kids at home, and she would say that was, if not the, probably one of the top few most important things that I did as a dad. And not all dads can do it. And there were times, you know, when I was traveling and I was not available and she would read. But I just made it a real important thing in the home for at least 10 years. And I think it benefited everyone. But here's the problem. In today's world, I would guess that just to counteract the negative input from all sources, you probably need to read out loud to kids 2.5 hours a day, just to counter the lack or the negative language input. And you're not going to do that, right? You do not have the time. Even if you thought you had the time, you would discover that you don't, right? I mean, I was lucky to get 45 minutes 3 or 4 days a week in the best of times. It's just hard. So there is a way that we can harness electricity to make up the differential. And that, of course, is audiobooks. Audiobooks are, I would say, the greatest invention next to modern dentistry and air travel. I mean, really, audiobooks are so magnificent. And with children, you can redeem the time. Now, I don't know where you live and what your life is, but we lived in California for 10 years. We did not do homeschooling. We did car schooling because for some reason, it seemed as though my wife was driving somebody somewhere or everybody everywhere. And I remember walking in the house, there's nobody there, thinking, how do you do homeschooling when you are never home. And of course, children in a car is really an unpleasant thing, right? As soon as you get in a car with children, they start complaining. It's too hot. It's too cold. I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. I gotta pee. When are we gonna be there? I used to think if I was a master chemist, I could design a spray with no side effects. You get in the car, you spray your children, and they all just go. Then you have a nice drive with your wife, listen to NPR, have a conversation. You get to your destination, you spray the antidote, and they'll wake up. Oh, we're here. I could become truly wealthy with something like that. But I noticed that a good audiobook almost has the same effect. And you get in the car, you put it on, and then pretty soon everybody forgets that they're too hot or too cold or that they got pee or they're hungry or whatever their problem is. They forget because they're not there. They are transported to Narnia or somewhere else. So you can redeem the time. I would also say that audiobooks are incredibly helpful, if not essential, for kids who aren't going to become avid readers on their own. So my son, number 6 out of the 7 children, was the most dyslexic child that I personally have ever met. He could not read anything, like not even 3 or 4 letter words until he was 10 years old. And he did not read a book until he was 12. But he listened to audiobooks like crazy. I mean, when you think about it, if you can't really look at letters or numbers, but you're homeschooling, what do? You can't do stuff on paper. So his whole life for 5 or 6 years was essentially listening to audiobooks, his whole education. And he would listen to audiobooks while he's playing with Legos or climbing trees or doing his chores or pretending to do math, right? I mean, he would listen 6, 7, 10 hours a day. In fact, any book you can think of that is appropriate for a child that age, he probably listened to more than once. And why am I telling you this? Because it's so interesting. When he did start to write fluently around 14, his writing was more eloquent in many ways than any of his sisters, even the ones who were reading Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe at 6, 7 years old. In a way, because he couldn't read with his eyes, he became more well-read because he got a much larger quantity of reliably correct and appropriately sophisticated language through literature into his mind. And when I said that he would walk in and say, "Father, dinner is on the table as I speak. Your presence is requested," he would have said that. That was the way he could talk if he wanted to. He would never talk like that around other children his age, but it was in there. So for children that are not going to become avid readers with their eyes, then what's so important is to get it in through the ears and to supplement what you can do reading aloud with the marvelous technology of audiobooks. It was funny, I came to this realization. You know, we tend to think about reading very narrowly, right? Especially in the world of schools, right? So reading is when you can decode symbols with your eyes and understand what it means well enough to answer questions on a multiple choice test, right? That's kind of the narrow funnel we get into. So I was talking with, what was happening? I was reading a book with one of my older daughters, she's a teenager, and we had 2 copies of the book. We're sitting on the couch reading, she's reading back and forth, talking about it, doing it right. The book was The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. And so we're reading this book. He walks in the room. He goes, "What are you guys reading?" And I said, "The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde." And he said, "Oh, I read that. I hated it." I said, "What did you just say? Did you just say you read this?" He goes, "Yeah." I said, "You don't read." He said, "Well, I listened to it. What's the difference? And I thought, that's the truth of it. What's the difference? And even these days, in fact, this very morning, I said to someone, I'm reading a book. Only the truth is, I am listening to it in my car as I drive back and forth, right? So you can read with your eyes. Some people read with their fingers. Why not reading with your ears? So you can kind of change that concept a little bit. So I came to the conclusion that if we want to improve general literacy as well as writing skills in school-age children in this country, the single most important thing we can possibly do is convince parents to read aloud and supplement with audiobooks as much as possible, because most kids today are not getting anywhere near what they will need to have that great database of language. Now, there's another way in which we build this database of language very powerfully, and kind of like the bedtime story, it has culturally been marginalized, or in some cases, completely lost. And that would be memorized language, which was really at the core of primary education from about the beginning of recorded history until probably 60, 70 years ago. In fact, there's an interesting little idiom that you may recognize if you have been exposed to books like Laddie, Little House on the Prairie, Anne of Green Gables. If you read a book about children in school in the 1800s, you are likely to come across this expression. You'll recognize it. You've never used it. No one in this room is old enough to have said it, but you might recognize it. I have to go to school and say my lessons. Have you ever heard that? Say my lessons. No one would ever use that expression because we don't do that. But 150 years ago, children were responsible for huge chunks of memorized language. Scripture, poetry, as they got a little bit older, excerpts from famous speeches. That was kind of part of the normal curriculum that in certain grades you would memorize and be able to recite on demand certain things. But it was probably a side effect of Deweyism that in the 20th century, memorization became kind of marginalized or unimportant. Dewey's attitude about memorized language or memorized anything was kind of, at best, it's unimportant or useless waste of time. And at worst, it stifles creativity. But this is not true. This is not true from so many aspects. And by eliminating the discipline of memorization from the lives of school children, we not only deprive them of all sorts of, physiological brain growth, which we'll get into later today, but also that beautiful database of eloquent language. And I could, probably regale you with a half an hour of stories that I could tell about how I have seen the memorized language come out in the spoken and written expression of children. I got my first glimpse into this a long, long time before I ever would have imagined, starting Institute for Excellence in Writing or being an English teacher or anything. I was living in Japan as a young man, studying music with Dr. Suzuki of Suzuki Method. If any of you are familiar with Suzuki Method, you'll know that one of the distinctives of the Suzuki Method approach to music instruction is to memorize the pieces on your violin or piano or cello or whatever and maintain a memorized repertoire. So I'm over there and I am very interested in all sorts of things that are distracting me from practicing my violin 6 hours a day, which is what I should have been doing. But one of the things that I was very interested in was the Japanese language. So I made effort to study the Japanese language. I spent all my spare time with Japanese girls because, of course, I was young at the time, and they were easier to understand and communicate with. But I lived with Japanese people. I actually got to the point where I taught myself to read and write the Japanese language up to about a grade 3-4 level. And I had been there, I don't know, a year and a half, and I just hit a wall. I don't know, maybe some of you, has anyone tried to learn a foreign language as an adult? So maybe you've shared this experience. I knew all the words that I needed to say anything that I wanted to say, and I could pretty much communicate anything as long as people were patient, willing to listen to me. And I also could understand everyone as long as they limited themselves to using Japanese according to proper grammar that I had learned in the Japanese textbook, right? So I was functional, but I always had that feeling like I just don't know if I said something well or naturally. And so I was kind of frustrated. I didn't know what to do. Yeah, I could learn more words, I could study more grammar, but I wanted to get like a breakthrough in fluency, and I wasn't quite sure. And then I thought, oh, I'm a Suzuki Method student. I should use Suzuki Method on myself to learn Japanese. I'm already in good condition in terms of environment and opportunity, but I didn't have the memorized patterns. So I decided to memorize. So I went to the bookstore, Kinokuniya bookstore, and I bought Jack and the Beanstalk in Japanese, because I thought, I know the story, right? Jaku Tomame no Ki. In Japanese. So I got the book, I took it to my Japanese teacher. I said, Sensei, I want to memorize this book, so would you please read it into this cassette tape player? That's how old. So I got this cassette, I'm listening to it, and I start memorizing this story, just like a little bit at a time, just a few words, and say it again and again and again until it's easy, and then add on a couple words and say it again and again and again until it's easy, and add on a few more words until it's easy, and I would recite to myself many times a day everything that I had learned, just trying to add in a tiny bit more, and I finally got it. And this was no wimpy little Jack and the Beanstalk. This was, you know, easily a couple hundred sentences worth of Jack and the Beanstalk. And I got it, and it changed my life in two ways. Number one, I could entertain children like you would not believe. I would go to someone's house for dinner, and I would start telling the kids, Mukashi, mukashi, Jack to you no konoma ga imashita. Jack wa itazura ko nandake. I'd probably go on for a while. And the kids were like, they had never seen anyone who could do this, let alone a big, ugly white guy with a funny accent, right? But the other thing I noticed, and this is the key idea here, I would be in conversation with someone, and a sentence or a clause or a phrase or some little piece of Jack and the Beanstalk would kind of hop out of the story in my mind. I could then change the words, the nouns, the verbs, the adjectives, the articles, whatever. I could change the words to say what I wanted to say using a grammatical template that I knew was correct. Now, I suspect I might have sounded a bit like a children's storybook when talking to people from time to time, but it was a huge breakthrough, a huge breakthrough. I came back from Japan. I taught violin for quite some time. I had some experience in the world of child brain development, and then I started IEW kind of as a side gig to see if I could make a little extra money and afford to be a violin teacher. And then things went pretty well, and so I switched over, and I don't teach music anymore, but I did go to a school once. This was a school in Washington State, and I was doing teacher training and doing some demonstration classes, and it was a very high Hispanic transient farm worker population in Washington State. And so I was in a class, and all the kids, their first language was Spanish, right? And so I'm teaching a writing lesson, and I'm doing a little keyword outline. They're all copying the keyword outline. And then I said, okay, I'm going to give you some homework. Okay, my intention was for them to take the keyword outline and go and try to tell it back to someone, you know, a friend, a mom, dad, relative, cat, I don't care. But I wanted them to talk through the keyword outline. And so when I said this word, I said, I'm going to give you homework. This whole little group of children erupted. Homework, oh, homework, I hate you, you stink. I wish I could wash you right down the sink. Oh, homework, you're giving me fits. If I had a bomb, I would blow you to bits. And they went on for three stanzas. This is, of course, Jack Paletsky's poem. They had all memorized this poem. And so after that, I was quite amazed. I had never been in a public school and seen something like this before. And I asked the teacher, I said, how did you know the value of having these kids memorize poetry? And she said, well, I'm from Puerto Rico, and English is my second language. And when I came here for school, I decided to memorize English poems to build my vocabulary. I thought, oh, so she had that personal experience that I had in Japan of expanding your capacity with a language through building memorized repertoire. So it's very powerful. Now, I do believe we've lost the culture. I would say there are some maybe religious traditions that have preserved the idea of memorized language through prioritizing scripture or prayers or something in that zone. But all children can benefit from poetry as well. And there are a few reasons. Number one, poets have to use a wider range of vocabulary, right, to say what they want to say. They also tend to use a wider range of grammatical constructs. So it exposes and ingrains in children a wider range of sophisticated, but usually correct, language patterns. That's going to come out in their speaking and writing because they will naturally do what I was found myself naturally doing, which is changing words but keeping patterns. So I want to strongly recommend that you do poetry memorization with your children, with your students, with yourself even. Now, a few bits of advice if you're feeling a little convicted on this point. Number one is I would recommend that you use poems that are grammatically correct, right? Because there are poems that don't use complete sentences, right? There's also poems that are so old, they just aren't really correct by a modern standard. So I'm not saying there's no value in memorizing something like Shakespeare. There's plenty of value. But for our purposes, there's kind of a golden age of poetry, if you will. Poetry is easier to remember because it has more predictable patterns, right? So because poets use rhyme schemes and rhythmic schemes to be able to construct what is appealing to us aesthetically, then they're easier to remember. And so there's a memory aid there with poetry as well. The next and probably most important thing is don't do it kind of like you might have done it in school. I remember we still memorized some poems, but it kind of went like this. You'd memorize a poem and then you would recite it. And then you would not do anything for a while. And then you'd memorize another poem and recite that, but you would forget the first one. And then you would memorize another poem and recite that, but you wouldn't remember the first two. And so you'd spend a whole year, maybe memorize 10 poems, but how many do you know at the end of the year? One. Then summer hits, everything evaporates, and now you don't know anything. So the trick is to maintain the memorized repertoire. That's the power of Suzuki method, is maintaining the memorized repertoire where the music you're playing just gets better and better and better and better because it's easier and easier and easier and easier. And that's what we can do with poetry memorization as well. So I got all excited about this idea and I created a product called linguistic, catchy title here, Linguistic Development Through Poetry Memorization, which essentially was a Suzuki method for memorizing poetry. So five levels, 20 poems for the first four levels, 20 excerpts from famous speeches for level five. And of all the things I have done in my life, that is still my favorite thing, because it's such a joy to have memorized poetry. I would like to finish and kind of share with you, I guess you might call it confidential or not completely well-known information about me, but I do not have any formal education, training in either teaching or English. I suppose this makes me particularly well qualified to travel around the world and do teacher training in English composition. No, my education, the formal part of it, was Suzuki Method violin. And when I was in school, I was really a bad student. I did as little as possible almost all the time. I am a profoundly uneducated human being. That's the truth. So how is it that I ended up, you know, writing and speaking and teaching people how to do this relatively successfully? I want to share with you the secret of my education. And that is my father's boat. Now you're probably wondering, how does a boat educate you? Well, my father was an engineer and he worked to live and he lived to sail. So from the time I was born until the time I left home, we had a sailboat, 30 some feet long. And every weekend when the weather was good, which was about half the time or more in Southern California, we would get on our little boat and we would sail about 20 miles over the sea to a little island called Catalina Island. And we would anchor our boat there and we would stay there for one night or two nights or three nights. And as I got older, he got more vacation time. And so, you know, sometimes we were there for a week. He just loved this. Now you're still wondering what's so good about a boat. I will tell you, there is nothing to do on a boat. It is profoundly boring. I mean, you know, during the day, yeah, you can swim and you can hike and you can build sandcastles and jump off rocks and snorkel around and spearfish. But in the evening, nothing. Nothing to do. There was no radio. There was no TV. There was no cell phone. There was no internet. It was blackout, right? But what did we do? Well, it was just my mother, my father, my sister, and me. We're in this boat. And my mother would read. She read the stories and the books. My father, I've never seen him read a whole book. He's an engineer. He read sailing magazines, but he would read the poetry. And so my sister and I were in the front of the boat in our little bunks there. And every night, for I don't know how long, it seemed like a pretty long time, probably 15, 20, 30 minutes, he would read poems. The same poems again and again and again, week after week after week, month after month, year after year. I could not memorize poetry. And as I heard the poem more and more, I started to like it more and more. And as I liked it, I got motivated to then get the book and memorize it myself. So I memorized a good number of poems, not because anybody told me to, but just because the environment was such that I wanted to. And memorizing poems became very handy. As I got older, I would like babysit kids. I could recite poems to them. I remember going to summer camp, sitting around the campfire, and I could recite poems to all the other kids at the campfire, and they thought I was like super. It was very handy. And to this day, I even have some poems that I have been able to maintain and share with people. So you probably like to hear a poem, huh? This is my favorite of all the poems. You might recognize it, you might not. It's called The Embarrassing Episode of Little Miss Muffet by Guy Wetmore Carroll. Little Miss Muffet discovered a tuffet, which never occurred to the rest of us, and as 'twas a June day, and just about noonday, she wanted to eat, like the best of us. Her diet was whey, and I hasten to say it is wholesome, and people grow fat on it. But the spot being lonely, the lady not only discovered the tuffet, she sat on it. A rivulet gabbled and babbled beside her, as rivulets are commonly thought to do, and dragonflies sported around and cavorted, as poets say dragonflies ought to do. While glancing aside, for a moment she spied a horrible sight which brought fear to her. A hideous spider was sitting beside her, and most unavoidably near to her. Albeit unsightly, this creature politely said, "Madam, I earnestly vow to you, I am penitent that I did not bring my hat. I should certainly otherwise bow to you." Though anxious to please, he was so ill at ease that he lost all his sense of propriety, and he grew so inept that he clumsily stepped in her plate, which is barred in society. This curious error completed her terror. She shuddered, and growing much paler, not only left the tuffet, but dealt him a buffet, which doubled him up in a sailor knot. Now, it must be explained that at this he was pained. He said, "Madam, I have vexed you, no doubt of it. Your fist like a truncheon. You're still in my luncheon," was all that she answered. "Get out of it." Now, the moral is this. Be it madam or miss to whom you have something to say, you're only absurd when you get in the curd, but you're rude when you get in the way. Now, I don't know. I've known that poem so long, I'm not sure I got every single word of it perfectly correct, but you can see what a joy it is to have something like that that you can share with people. And I've tried to pass this on, and so sometimes I will get little videos or audios, or if I am seeing my grandchildren in person, very often I will see my grandchildren reciting memorized poetry, continuing the tradition. So I would strongly recommend, if you're doing a lot of memorization, keep at it. Don't give up, and don't let anyone convince you that it isn't of high value, a very good use of your time. If you're doing a little bit of memorization, do more, because it will bless your children and their children for generations. And if you're not doing any poetry memorization, you're totally blowing it. So get with the program. And the good news is, if you need something to do, you can use ours. And I would say, you know, all except one of the poems in the poetry memorization program are in the public domain. So they're all old, they're well known, they're beautiful, and I didn't want to have to pay, you know, royalties. But they're classics, they're good. And use the method that we teach of maintaining the repertoire. We tried to make it very boy friendly, because, you know, I've just noticed most girls are like okay with everything, but boys, you kind of have to catch their imagination, right? If you can catch their imagination with something that's funny, or maybe a little disgusting, or violent, or preferably all three, like Jabberwocky, right? Then what happens is they gradually will fall in love with the language, and then they'll be very happy to memorize more and more and more. So those two things, if you want excellent communicators, if you want children to grow up and write and speak English skillfully, eloquently, competently, read out loud in huge quantity and memorize beautiful language. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Do you have questions or comments? Please contact the Institute for Excellence in Writing at 1-800-856-5815 or visit our website, iew.com.